there's like nobody in front of me. Everyone's in my peripheral vision. Which is maybe a good kind of like how it is with our lives, right? Everything, like we think we're sort of looking here, but actually it's all happening, you know, there. Yeah, that's how it is. So our minds are just always in such motion, don't you think? And lately I feel a little better this morning. I'm grateful for the practice today, as I was last night, more and more, you know. But boy, I really felt kind of overwhelmed the last few days. Have you felt a little overwhelmed? Just trying to navigate, you know, what do I need to personally do and how to respond to all the stuff that's out there and in here and my ideas about it all. And it's a lot. And it just gets the mind just moving. So, oddly enough, the next story in the Mumonkan is about the mind moving. So maybe that'll be helpful to us. This is case 29. Famous Zen story. Two monks were arguing about the temple flag waving in the wind. One said, "The flag is moving." The other said, "No, the wind is moving." They argued back and forth and they couldn't agree. The sixth ancestor, Wei Ning, said, he showed up, I guess, and said, "It's not the wind that moves. It's not the flag that moves. It's your mind that moves." The two monks were struck with awe. Or maybe the teacher showed up and they remembered they were supposed to be silent. The monastery, like here. But a famous Zen story, right, about perspective, about mind, about our limited kind of conventional way of looking at things that we seem to be real right in front of us, conventional way. There's not exactly anything wrong with our conventions and our concepts, really. It's not wrong to see a flag whipping around and say, "Look, there's a flag moving." We know the flag doesn't move on its own. We know it's the wind moving the flag, and then we think about it some more. We can think about the conditions that create the wind, and on it goes. But along comes this Zen master perspective saying, "No, it's the mind. It's your mind. That's this, you know." We would maybe say that's generating this, but maybe it's not generating it. Maybe the mind just is this. And of course, this is a simple example, flags and wind. Doesn't really matter that much. But maybe it's an example of something really more fundamental that actually is really important to what's going on. Really know how the mind moves more clearly. And I've been thinking this week or so, and these last 3.5 years and so, how easily the mind also moves towards fear, you know, and doubt and suspicion, distrust. Especially when the mind doesn't know what's coming next, which is like all the time. So for sure we don't know what's coming next with the coronavirus. I think there really is a big groundswell of fear arising in our communities and like around the world. It's agitating, it's upsetting. And we have different ways of coping with that fear, you know. As these levels of realization arrive. And that's interesting too, to watch the levels of realization arrive, you know, and watch the ways we resist or embrace or are frightened or not. You know, I'd read about this thing, of course, you know, who hadn't? But it wasn't personal, you know. It's happening somewhere far away. And even when I showed up in Washington and seemed that personal. But then somebody I actually know emailed to say, "Well, what are you guys doing at the Dharma Hall to keep us safe?" And I was like, "Holy shit, it's, you mean like here?" You know? You know, then suddenly it felt a lot more real. So it's interesting the way it lands in waves and layers, you know. So many ways to cope with that. You know, humor is definitely part of it. I appreciated Bob's joke last night. Just stop breathing. And I guess we better close our eyes, too, to cut off that mucous membrane. Seal off everything. But there is fear here, of course, and it's really the fear that's from our core fear, don't you think, of death. The opposite of what we all know as living beings that we can't know. We have this word to point to it, but we don't know what it is. Life and death, the great matter, says on the Han board there. And it's this thing we're swimming in as living beings, just like fish in water, right? That great analogy. Fish doesn't know that water is there. The living don't really know that death is there. But it is. So the merging of difference and unity, the Sandokai, which we've been studying here and we chanted this morning, that was handy. It says in there, all things have their merit expressed according to function and place. So does that include viruses? It says all things. So I decided to remind myself, it's great having the excuse of these talks, you know, you can look things up. And I decided to remind myself what a virus is. Maybe you remember this, but I didn't really remember it. It's pretty much a little scrap of DNA surrounded by a coat of protein and a layer of lipids, kind of a fat-like substance. That's like it, you know. No organs, no cells, you know. No eyes, ears, nose, you know. And there's a debate, a long-standing debate, I guess, in biology about whether to call viruses a life form or not. Whether they are beings, you know. Like, that's our filter, right? We're trying to take care of all beings. So this is relevant, you know. They don't have cells, but they do reproduce and evolve. And the article I glanced at called them organisms at the edge of life. You know, at the edge. So they're really quite mysterious. And the Sandokai honors that too, right? And honors darkness, honors mystery, honors unknowableness, not even knowing if this thing is a life form or not. And I think honoring that darkness is also honoring, you know, that our confusion, you know, as we are here in the light, trying to figure out what to do, how to respond to coronavirus, COVID. I don't know if you're supposed to say COVID or COVID, number 19. I watched a little bit, I can't remember if it was Trevor Noah or Stephen Colbert saying, you know you're in trouble when you're already on 19 before we've even heard of this thing. You know? So more humor. I guess 1 through 18 are already out there. So what is it, you know? Is it like a newly evolved life form that we're trying to share the planet with? Is it just a threat? Is it just death? Is it life? Is it death? We don't know. And so how do we meet that? How do we meet it in practical ways in the light as it moves our minds all over the place? How are we rational and sensible about it? How do we... And can we also explore our fears and our doubts and really know that the mind is moving at different levels, you know? There's a movement down deep. We don't always see it or feel it. We just feel the outcome of the surface of it moving around or something. And it just begs the question of how do we really meet this moment of being alive fully, you know? Not knowing how long that situation is going to continue. So it's interesting, too, that one of the practical core ideas is just like simple discipline. So hopefully Zen will help us out there. You know, this is a practice of discipline. wash your hands more and don't touch your face. And of course, then you start paying attention to that and you notice how often you don't wash your hands and how often you do touch your face. I was reading in one of the articles about saying that not touching your face could reduce your risk 40% or 60% or some high number. And they had done a study. So one of these, I love trick studies. They pointed a camera at a bunch of medical students during a lecture about infectious diseases and watched how often they all rubbed their eyes and picked their noses. It's a habit, you know. So there's a discipline piece here. But it's not going to save us, right? Even if we're perfect with that, it's not going to save us. CDC website says that transmission from surfaces is less likely. It's kind of this weird, nuanced expression. You want to see this is what they publish to the world. It's very, like, kind of vague, actually. The CDC website says it may be possible that a person can get COVID-19 by touching a surface or object that has the virus on it and then touching their own mouth, nose, or possibly near their eyes. But this is not thought to be the main way the virus spreads. So that's a lot of caveats. So you can scrub down the doorknobs all you like, you know. The real mechanism, of course, the real problem as usual, Sartre anticipated this, right? The real problem is people, you know, it's other people. People who are infected who sneeze or cough, as you know, CDC says you're in trouble if they're within 6 feet, you know, so we need like a 6-foot bubble. So, what's the practical thing to do there, right? If we're thinking about this in a very literal way, you know, in the light, pretty much stay away from everybody, right? Or at least stay away from people in person. Maybe now we should truly just live through our screens. Well, what kind of life is that, you know? Is that really being alive, hiding at home behind our screens? What are the impacts of that choice, you know? What are we giving up? And apparently you decided not to do that because you're here. So this is a big thing, you know? Maybe. We don't know what's going to happen. And I'm sure it's affecting all of us in different ways, and or if it hasn't yet, it will. Mindfulness Northwest, where I also work, has two classes going on right now in Kirkland, of all places. The epicenter of the Washington State outbreak. Did not make me happy to see Kirkland, Washington on the front homepage of the Washington Post. I'm like, no! But then, of course, you realize how self-centered that is, and a moment later you're like, oh my gosh, these poor people at that nursing home. And then yesterday afternoon, you know, I was trying to kind of get through my day and get stuff done and like prepare for this. And then the King County Public Health Department issued guidance that everyone in King County should avoid non-essential gatherings of 10 people or more. I don't know if they, you know, if they've ever issued that guidance before or not. And we can make the argument that doing something like Zen Sesshin or a mindfulness class is definitely essential, but maybe not in the short term. Probably in the long term. So I got all agitated and had to decide, you know, with my colleagues, should we start canceling classes or moving them online? And eventually decided not to do it in a big rush, but starting next week, we should just go online. But our minds are all moving, right? You know, fear, resistance, what a hassle. Is this just going to confuse people? Is this going to cause more problems? The other thing King County Public Health recommendation said is they recommended that schools not close. That was Wednesday at about 3 o'clock. And then Wednesday at about 11 o'clock, the Northlake School District, which includes Kirkland, closed for 2 weeks. Quarantine and disinfect 23,000 students are home, sudden 2-week vacation. So yeah, we don't know what to do, do we? The superintendent of the Northlake School District wrote in her statement, which the media report, and this is like this funny implied criticism, wrote in her lengthy statement, it said in there. Maybe the reporters thought it was too much. Anyway, she wrote, "We are taking the strategic approach not because we think by doing so we will stop an epidemic. We are simply trying to do our part to slow the spread of COVID-19. And we are no longer able to provide quality instruction and maintain an environment that's safe." And the article implied that one of the main reasons was so many parents were already keeping their kids home. The classes were sort of getting all, you know, unviable. It's hard to teach when half the kids are gone, you know. So there's this threat, and we're trying to respond to it in different ways. Some experts ignoring other experts, apparently. You can't be too safe, but is that really true? So maybe we have some things to offer in our practice. And maybe people who are not into this stuff don't need to hear this from us, but we can be examples of some kind of self-awareness or groundedness or patience or something. I was thinking particularly of the 5 remembrances, great Buddhist training verse, to really remember how it actually is and live accordingly. Here's one version of the 5 remembrances. "I'm of the nature to grow old. There's no way to escape growing old. I'm of the nature to have ill health. There is no way to escape having ill health. I'm of the nature to die. There is no way to escape death. All that is dear to me and everything that I love are of the nature to change. There's no way to escape being separated from them. My actions are my only true belongings. I cannot escape the consequences of my actions. My actions are the ground on which I stand." It's powerful stuff, huh? So remembering old age, sickness, and death, remembering change, and remembering the incredible power of karma, you know, of action. I heard secondhand, I haven't verified this part, that the virus hopped from bats in a wild game stall in a market in Wuhan, China. And I was noticing, as my friend told me this with scorn in my reaction, of course I agreed with him, we're always agreeable, but I noticed how easy it is to be like really judgmental of cultural practices like that. Who eats bats, you know? Yeah. But apparently they do. Who am I to say that's good or bad? But wow, talk about the power of cause and effect, right? Might it be, you know, that all the, you know, with all the things that lined up, that one butcher's knife and one meat stall and one market in one town on the other side of the planet would lead directly to 9 people, older people, true, but 9 people dying sooner than they would have otherwise in Kirkland, Washington. It's amazing. Power of our actions is truly awesome, you know, there's no question. So on the one hand, of course we want to do everything that's smart about a virus outbreak, of course we do. On the other hand, it does change the feeling, I think, in our approach if we really practice deeply with this, you know. We really examine the way our mind's moving and our fears. And remember, this is not like, oh, right, death, dang, I forgot, you know. No, you know. And of course, people are running around also reminding us that so-called seasonal flu and so-called common cold, and those sound like very tame, like those are tame-sounding terms, right? You know, novel coronavirus, COVID-19, is not a tame term, you know. these other terms sound tame, but many people die partly as a result of those too, right? Every year. So is it a disaster or just normal everyday life or both? And how do we practice with all this? The branching streams flow on in the dark. So we know that every action has a result, but we cannot know what the result will be, really. It's happening in the dark. I mean, our choices are informed, for sure, by the cumulative knowledge of our previous actions that we have noticed in the light, but it's actually happening in the dark and the light. The spiritual source shines clear in the light, it says. So there's clarity and there's darkness. Another way of talking about this, another killer Buddhist zinger that you should not tell your friends, is death is certain. Only the time of death is uncertain. Mm-hmm. That would be a good way to kill the conversation. And people, what are you going to do about coronavirus? Well, death is certain. Only the time of death is uncertain. All this from something so tiny, you know, we couldn't see it without a powerful microscope. Life changing and asserting itself, living and dying. And living and dying, of course, is another way, right, for us to explore this light and this darkness that the poem is talking about, that our practice, our life is about. And that death is a natural motion. What living means would like to not be too quick. So it's already a year next Wednesday since our dear early Red Cedar member and friend Nancy Welsh died from cancer, on top of a long list of things that she had had for years. So it's a little debatable, too, to say cause of death, too, right? You know, I mean, the ultimate cause of death is being born. But so many factors go into dying. But Nancy, like everybody else who dies, she was so alive until she wasn't, you know? She was in motion, my goodness. Huh? Even when she's pretty much stuck in her bed at home, man, she was in motion. Dynamic, fast-moving person. And she's still in motion, right? Still in motion in the mind, in our hearts. So the wind does move, you know? The flags are flapping. And yet here at the Zendo, we also have this great gift of stopping. And we have received these great teachings, you know, we're really lucky. These great teachings on how to calm this movement down at least a little bit, you know, and how to accept it too. That it's really both, you know, this odd combination. This is another light and dark thing, right, you know. On the light side, we do want to calm our minds down a little bit. Wouldn't that be nice? But to recognize the darkness aspect of all this is that minds are just fine, just the way they are, too. So one of the great treasures of Buddha's teaching is that it's truly liberating to just really be mindful, just really be aware and present to the actual processes that we call me, you know, that we call life. Our body and our breath, our feelings, our thoughts, our emotions, these complex patterns that result from all this, our karma. So just to be aware of all this is liberating, is freeing, is transformational. And the Buddha was, you know, kind, you know, like one way to look at it is all the teachings are provisional and kind of like a generous act, you know, that the Buddha could see deeply. He could see in the darkness, you know, but he jumped out into the light to give us some ideas, you know, try this, you know. He spoke the teachings. There's all this great stuff in the Enlightenment story about the Buddha, like, oh, I don't know, I shouldn't say anything, you know. They're not going to get it. you know, those stories. It's really fun stories. And then eventually he thought there were no gods in Buddhism, but God came down and said, oh, no, Buddha, there's some that will understand. So he said, all right, you know, I'll go. I'll make that my life's work, you know. And then the first person who comes along, the Buddha is all excited and trying to explain enlightenment. And the first guy who comes along kind of goes, huh, ignores him. So even the Buddha had these problems, you know, how do you explain all this? But anyway, eventually one of his teachings, you know, the next guys, you know, I think they were mostly men at first, sadly. Some of the next people, he gave these instructions. And they're pretty simple. Instructions on really being mindful of our breath and our body, of our minds, moment after moment. First, to encourage us that even though this is simple and sounds like pretty, you know, boring or something, it's really going to be transformational. So first in the sutra and all this, he says, these practices, this way, is the direct path for purification of beings, the direct path to overcoming sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and distress, for the attainment of the right method, for the realization of unbinding, total freedom, nirvana. This great path is the four foundations of mindfulness. And then he starts into it, you know. So I thought we could focus, and we've looked at this stuff before, of course, but it never gets old, you know. That we could return to the first foundation. Such a good thing to practice in Sishin. The foundation of breath and body. Body breath. So first the Buddha gives us like a little instructions on how to set yourself up, which I think we're doing pretty well. Here he said, a monk having gone to the wilderness, to the shade of a tree, or to an empty building, sits down, folds her legs crosswise, holds her body erect, and sets mindfulness to the fore. So I guess we can call this an empty building. It's pretty empty. So sit down, pay attention to the posture, and set mindfulness to the fore. Always mindful. She breathes in, always mindful, he breathes out. And it goes on, but you could stop there, really, you know. You could really stop there. Another nice translation of this first instruction I find really helpful is breathing in, knowing you're breathing in. Breathing out, knowing you're breathing out. So really knowing it, you know, really knowing it. So of course it goes on, it gets a lot more elaborate, but Dogen tells us, we'll chant this tomorrow. And I think Chris might give us some more comments on it, hopefully. Dogen says, one practice is enough, you know. To know one practice is to do one practice. Just pick a practice and stay with it. Stay with it to the end. Commit. Breathing in, knowing you're breathing in. Breathing out, knowing you're breathing out. And the next little bit, though, he does helpfully expand what he means by breathing and really tells us that it can be any kind of breath. It doesn't have to be a particular breath. There's no like special kind of breath, you know. We want to do it right, you know, but there's no right or wrong here. He goes on, it gets a little repetitive, it's a style of discourse. Breathing in a long breath, he knows he is breathing in a long breath, or breathing out a long breath, she knows she is breathing out a long breath. Or breathing in a short breath, he knows he is breathing in a short breath. Or breathing out a short breath, he knows he is breathing out a short breath. Da 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 da. Very systematic, you know. And lots of other variables too, you know. Breathing shallowly, breathing deeply, breathing quickly, breathing slowly. It's not about the right kind of breathing, it's about the knowing of it, the being in it. So this ritual we're doing, and this whole thing is one giant ritual, and it's amazing we're pulling it off. I always am amazed. Not as many of us as sometimes, and in a way that's a great opportunity, a little easier to be really quiet, really focused, even though we all have five different jobs. But anyway, this ritual we're doing is called, oops, I almost rubbed my face. That itches, ooh. Anyway, this ritual, Seishin, has two characters, and it literally means something like touching the heart-mind. So I think the Buddha is suggesting this awareness of breathing is a great way to do that. A great way to touch in really deeply, to really touch into your heart-mind through breath and body. But of course, the mind is moving, as the story pointed out. Flags and winds and minds. The mind is blown around, right? Like a feather in the wind, or maybe we can eventually make it like a kite and find a way to anchor that string. But still, the mind is moving, moving, moving. Thoughts, emotions, fears, memories, other things we really should be doing, so on and so on. So easy for the conscious mind to lose track of the breath, and that's part of it, right? That's okay. But let's be serious, though, you know. Let's be determined, but gentle. And just keep inviting our mind to we move gently back to the breath and the body. And this idea of invitation, I think, is really helpful. And maybe it's not, like, it's better to let go of the idea that the mind is in charge of this project. Maybe that's a little upside down, you know. Maybe that's the light without the darkness, to think I'm in charge of this Zazen thing, I'm in charge of this Zen thing, my mind. Maybe we can let the breath be in charge. And have it more like the breath is inviting the mind, you know, to settle, to come back to harmony with the breath and the body. And the cool thing is that the breath, unlike the mind, doesn't know how to be impatient or miffed or annoyed. That even though the breath issues this invitation, every single darn breath, right? Right? Breathing in, the breath is like, come on, mind. Breathing out, the breath's like, come on, mind. The breath doesn't mind that the mind blows off the invitation. Doesn't even RSVP, you know? Doesn't show up, you know? The breath just keeps inviting the mind. And eventually the mind notices, you know what I mean? So this is a trustworthy process, I think. It takes a little energy, but you can trust it. Eventually the mind gets interested in this other possibility besides just blowing around like crazy, you know? And eventually we really understand and feel that the Buddha wasn't just being over the top there with that thing about how revolutionary and powerful and how this heals everything, this direct path for the purification of beings. Overcoming sorrow and lamentation. It's a funny translation, lamentation. But it will definitely be lamenting, you know, sooner or later, right? I guess it is, I think there's a lot they still don't know about this virus, but it is pretty clear that it's going to impact older people the most. Apparently the flu epidemic of 1918 affected kids and older people. I was reading about that, and so far, it seems like this is not affecting kids too much, so that's lucky. But I know plenty of people over 80. I'm sure you do too, you know. We have several in our Sangha. Several in this room are on their way. We're all on our way. So there's going to be lamentation, you know. I read a blog post by a doctor, and, you know, who knows how anybody knows these things. This seemed like a trustworthy source as far as I could tell. And she was saying, this is a powerful statement, she said in this blog post, people you know will die from coronavirus. Like, that puts it in perspective, that lands it in a certain way. Wow. But maybe the Buddha's not kidding, that mindfulness of breath and body and all these other dimensions of our being can help us be a little more free even as we grieve our losses. A little more aware of what the mind's doing down to the depths, you know. So that there's sadness and acceptance, right? Light and darkness. That it's terrible and it's completely okay, completely normal. Beings have been dying through this mechanism since we evolved, you know? We evolved and viruses evolved and keep evolving. So I just want to make this suggestion, you know? Let's really practice deeply with breath and body. Maybe that's already your central focus, but maybe you can return to it a little more fully, or you can really renew this. And one last suggestion that can support this is the wonderful practice of breath counting. It's a great practice. So just lightly tagging each exhalation with a number, you know, 1, 2, 3, you know. Maybe you get to 10 and go back to 1. A lot more likely you get to 4.5 and aren't sure if you're on 5.5, you know. And you go back to 1. Mind is moving, right? It's probably better to think of breath counting as returning to 1 than to think of it as counting to 10. That's probably a more helpful frame. So then when you return to 1, you're not like, oh darn, I'm not counting to 10. You can say, oh, I'm doing it right, I'm returning to 1. Good. 1. Not mechanical, you know, letting the breath, again, the breath is issuing the invitation, not the mind. Not like the mind is like, okay, breath, you will now count from 1 to 10. I have deemed it so, you know. The mind, if the breath could talk back, the breath would be funny, right? Like, oh yeah, good luck with that mind. But if we let the breath do it, we can do it. So that's a great support. You might begin each Zazen period with a few minutes of breath counting, or and then maybe just let the numbers get lighter and lighter and lighter, just like so gentle, you know, until the numbers are just kind of a feeling or an idea or a sense and not there at all. Just breathing. Breathing in, knowing you're breathing in. Breathing out, knowing you're breathing out. So the counting, you know, isn't like a beginner's thing. Or like a crutch. Done with the whole heart, it's really deep, wonderful practice, I think. And there's a Suzuki Roshi story about this, actually. It's retold in Crooked Cucumber. That one time, Suzuki Roshi, must have been summertime, was down at the swimming hole on Tassajara Creek at Tassajara Monastery. And he wasn't much of a swimmer. Maybe his generation, they didn't learn how to swim. And he slipped in and he just about drowned, you know. The young students were kind of splashing around and goofing off all around him. And there he was in the water, you know, almost drowned. And this is funny Zen master stuff. His first thought apparently was not, I wish I'd taken swimming lessons. His first thought was, oh no, I am not composed and ready to meet my death. My practice is incomplete. So somehow he struggled out of the water and he resolved to really take up breath counting again. And he asked all the students to take up breath counting. So anyway, there's breath counting from the edge of death, which is where we are all the time anyway, right? Coronavirus or no. So two monks were arguing about the temple flag waving in the wind, and one said, the flag is moving. The other said, no, the wind is moving. They argued back and forth. Couldn't agree. The sixth ancestor, Wei Nin, said, it's not the wind that's moved. It's not moves. It's not the flag that moves. It's your mind that moves. The two monks were struck with awe. So in the great tradition of commenting on koans, I'm going to argue a little bit with the great waning. It is the mind that moves for sure, but isn't it also that the wind moves and the flag moves? What is there that's not moving? Everything is moving, everything is in flux. And yet somehow we can feel so deeply in our practice that there's still somehow a stillness woven through all this motion. An anchoredness, you know, a rootedness that's not disturbed by the constant motion. Maybe that's what's happening in the dark. That our fear includes non-fear, you know, even as we prepare to mourn some extra deaths from a new virus. So we're lucky, you know, I admit to a certain degree of resistance yesterday, maybe you had a little bit of that. Oh man. But once you get here, I think you realize, you remember after a while, if you haven't remembered yet, you know, maybe you can take my word for it, that this is great, this is perfect. So Sheen came along at the right time, and just the right people are here to practice together, to breathe in, to breathe out, knowing we're breathing in, knowing we're breathing out, to wash our hands, knowing we're washing our hands, to not touch our faces, knowing we're not touching our faces. And when we screw up, you know, naturally enough, when we lose track of our mind and our breathing and our hands and our finger up our nose or something, oops, or God, I'm going to get that gunk out of the corner of my eye, you know, I'm going to get it all, you know, we can just start again. We can pause. We can listen for the invitation from the breath, the body, the heart. We can feel really fortunate that we are able to hear this invitation at least once in a while, you know? To really touch the heart mind. To really be in deep contact with our deep heart. So I'll close with a short poem that maybe says something like this. This is a poet named Martha Postlethwaite. It's called Clearing. Like a clearing. Do not try to save the whole world or do anything grandiose. Instead, create a clearing in the dense forest of your life. And wait there patiently until the song that is your life falls into your own cupped hands and you recognize it and greet it. Only then will you know how to give yourself to this world so worth of rescue. Do not try to save the whole world or do anything grandiose. Instead, create a clearing in the dense forest of your life and wait there, patiently, till the song that is your life falls in your own cupped hands and you recognize and greet it. Only then will you know how to give yourself to this world so worth of rescue. Okay, thanks for listening to all that. Hopefully it was helpful in some way. Just continue. And I get a little unhelpfully naggy about silence, so I'll try to restrain myself, but it really is a great opportunity, I think, a little group like this. We all know this practice, and we can really just be so settled, you know, just take care of things. No rush, one thing after the next. Not talking any more than we absolutely have to. Just this opportunity, you know. We work hard to create this possibility. So let's really do our best with that.